It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge has deemed a portion of Wisconsin's right-to-work law unconstitutional. We'll learn more in a bit. First, the White House announced yesterday that it would impose sanctions against Russia and expel 35 Russian diplomats from the U.S. over the next couple of days. The move from the Obama administration is in response to evidence that shows Russian hackers had meddled in the U.S. presidential election and could potentially have had an impact on the outcome. Missy Ryan is with us now to explain the situation. She's the national security reporter for The Washington Post and has been following the story. Missy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So what kind of sanctions specifically are we looking at here?
So the United States has announced sanctions on two Russian intelligence agencies, a number of Russian officials, and then several other Russian individuals who are believed, all of which are believed to be associated with hacks and or harassment of U.S. diplomats.
And how are sanctions like this implemented? Kind of what are the nuts and bolts of it?
So this is run by the Treasury's sanctions office, and you know, it's a good question, and it's open for debate at the extent to which they actually will affect Russian officials and Russian institutions, because a lot of them may not do banking in the West in the way that, you know, might actually bite more from a sanctions perspective. But the idea is that they won't have access to funds, that they, you know, won't be able to do business with U.S. banks. And so the idea is really to punish them. And part of it is also is just sending a signal to businesses and to sort of shame the Russian government for what the United States has, you know, deemed to be this brazen interference with the 2016 presidential election.
So that part of this action might be a little more on the symbolic end, but there are also some expulsions that are happening as well. Quite a few Russian representatives in the U.S. are being expelled. Who is subject to that part of these sanctions?
So these are 35 Russian officials described by the United States government as intelligence officials who are now deemed persona non grata, meaning that they had to leave the country, I believe, in 72 hours. So presumably they're in the process of packing their bags right now. Yeah. And the idea is that these are people who were either directly or indirectly involved with this this activity, or perhaps just as a, you know, may have been unluckily singled out as because the United States wanted to take some sort of diplomatic censure action as well. At the same time, there's also a move that's happening to close two diplomatic compounds in the United States, one of which is this sort of country estate, a dacha, if you will, mm-hmm. in the eastern shore of Maryland, where the, you know, the Russian embassy in Washington is used for a retreat, and another facility that has a sort of similar purpose on Long Island.
So to impose these sanctions, President Obama broadened an existing executive order from 2015 that allows him to address cyber attacks. Once he leaves office, would then President Trump be able to simply rescind the sanctions?
Yes, he will be. And that is sort of the crux of the question here. You know, what lasting effect, if any, will this action have? You know, this was sort of unveiled to great fanfare yesterday and a sign of, you know, great U.S. displeasure with Russia. At the same time, President-elect Trump has repeatedly waved off the suggestion that Russia interfered with the election, cast doubt on the conclusions that have been reached, not just by the CIA, but also the FBI and other intelligence agencies. And, you know, American officials acknowledged yesterday when discussing the new measures that, you know, it's an executive action and it can be reversed. All of the steps can be reversed by the next president. Now, it would be difficult politically, perhaps, for Trump to do so, because there are a lot of Republicans in Congress who are very angry, members of Trump's own party, who are very angry about the Russian interference and who actually want the administration to do much more than it's doing now. They say that this is overdue. They've been pressuring the White House for weeks to do something. And so it would put Trump in a sort of difficult position of having to actually soften measures against Russia at a moment where there's a lot of anger, you know, from his own party.
Well, and it is also interesting because the president-elect has declined regular security briefings that are standard for presidents and presidents-elect. But at the same time, as you said, he and his staff have said that they haven't seen compelling evidence of the hacks. From your research into this topic, Missy, is the evidence there if someone wants to see it?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously we don't have access to all the classified information, but, you know, it just based on my own experience in dealing with these kinds of issues, I don't think that the U.S. government would be taking the actions that it's taking and speaking so conclusively in public if it didn't feel like it had conclusive evidence that it could share with the president, this president or the next president, in a classified setting. And now Trump yesterday, again, sort of downplayed the significance of, you know, the Russian hack generally, said that, you know, the United States needed to move on to bigger and better things. At the same time, he said that he would want to have a briefing about it. So, you know, maybe this is an indication that he actually sort of coming to realize that this is an issue that he can't just blow off and that he needs to take seriously, given the intensity of the reaction in Washington, not just from the Obama administration.
We're talking with Missy Ryan. She's a national security reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the sanctions imposed yesterday by President Obama on Russia related to cyber attacks during the 2016 election period. Now, the U.S. also imposed sanctions on Russia in the wake of Russia's annexation of the Crimea from Ukraine. Do we have a sense of how effective, if at all, those have been?
You know, they certainly don't seem to have deterred Russian activity in Ukraine. You know, they have seized the Crimea Peninsula, and, you know, there are Russian activities still occurring in eastern Ukraine, or Russian-supported activities. And so, you know, I don't think that if the goal was to get Russia out of Ukraine, I don't think that has happened. You know, on the other hand, the Russian economy is not doing well. I mean, I think that, you know, there's an argument to be made that it's better than nothing, but perhaps didn't have the desired effect. And so you could hypothesize the same thing about these sanctions, even if they were to be in place. They might not have a whole lot of real-world effect, but they do have some sort of impact in terms of, you know, calling out the Russian government and sort of setting the stage for a new phase in U.S.-Russian relations, where there's sort of a more open hostility than we've seen in some time.
Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced that he would not follow President Obama's suit and expel U.S. diplomats from Russia, even though Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the Russian Foreign Ministry had actually petitioned him to do so. Was that a surprise that Putin would take the not very strongman approach that he often seems to favor?
Well, I think it's not so surprising if you think about the fact that we're only a couple of weeks now from 3 weeks from the inauguration of the new president. And so, you know, I mean, he can decide to do this later, but it, you know, it sounds like he wants to see how things are going to go with Trump. And, you know, maybe this is his bid to give the president an opening to actually, as we discussed earlier, reverse some of these actions in a way that would allow for a new stage and sort of warmer relations between Moscow and Washington. And so I think from that perspective, it's not a huge surprise, but I don't think that we should think that things are going to be rosy necessarily when Trump takes over. But certainly, given Trump's statements, given the nature of some of his appointments for his cabinet and his senior advisors, it does seem that he will at least consider a different kind of approach to Russia than the Obama administration has taken.
Interestingly, Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov did say late yesterday, quote, "I cannot say what the response will be, although, as we know, there is no alternative here to the principle of reciprocity," end quote. So it sounds like, at least from other parts of the Kremlin, we're hearing that we might not be doing something today, but don't be mistaken that Right. We're not going to do anything. Are there any hints of what that might look like?
Well, you know, it could be, you know, it could be expulsions in the future. It could be, you know, other sorts of retaliation that happened in the covert sphere. I mean, U.S. officials have been very clear that they believe that Russia intends to continue to interfere, do these cyber operations, not just in American elections, but in European elections, in a way that would mimic what happened this fall. And so, you know, I think that the Russians are reserving a right to do something in the future. We can assume that both they and the United States are actively exploring, if not already conducting, covert cyber operations.
There have been suggestions from President Obama, although it doesn't sound like there's clear proof of this, that the orders for these hacks must have come from the highest level in Russia, meaning from President Vladimir Putin. Do you think that it's likely that this was directed by Putin, or that someone lower than that would have taken this very bold and, you know, fairly risky step on their own?
Yeah, it seems to me unconceivable that he couldn't have had at least some level of knowledge of this occurring. Maybe not right away, but certainly when it became such an issue and the response was so significant in the United States. And President Obama, I mean, I think I understand, it's understandable that they don't want to name him personally. That sort of ups the ante in a way that could be dangerous. But, you know, it's pretty clear what Obama and other senior officials are saying, that they believe, you know, they're saying that it was approved by the highest level of the government. And, you know, Putin is a leader who gets involved in all the big decisions. And so I think that, you know, that the real conclusion there is pretty clear.
You mentioned earlier, Missy, that there is a lot of concern within President-elect Trump's own party about the fact that it would appear that the Russians interfered in our election, not necessarily saying that it skewed the results by any means, but that there was interference and that there is a lot of concern. John McCain and others have expressed that quite directly. But then we have President-elect Trump, who speaks very highly of Vladimir Putin. We have the Secretary of State nominee, Rex Tillerson, who has done extensive business deals with Russia and has been actually awarded medals by the Russian government. Do you think that the Republicans, many of whom were not in favor of Trump being the nominee for their party in the first place and have made that clear, are they actually going to be able to have much sway in how this plays out once we're past inauguration?
You know, I don't think that the Trump administration is going to be able to ignore members of its own party in Congress. But, you know, Trump seems to, you know, sort of make a lot of decisions from the hip, or at least statements from the hip. And so, you know, with all sort of prognostications regarding what the Trump administration is going to do on of a number of foreign policy issues, I think it's just too soon to say. You would assume that he would want to keep members of his party in Congress in his good graces, if only to be able to advance some of his legislative priorities, but you never know.
And this weekend actually marks the 25th anniversary of the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the start of what was a warmer, if not completely warm, relationship with Russia following that Cold War. Is there some concern that we could return to chillier relations over issues like the cyber attacks and issues like the conflict in Syria?
Certainly. I mean, you know, there have been a number of rocky periods since the end of the Cold War. There have been expulsions in 2001 and 2010 of diplomats and some sort of, you know, moments of tension. But I think, you know, obviously the last few years has witnessed a significant deterioration in U.S.-Russian relations, starting in 2014 with the Ukraine activity. And the situation in Syria has, you know, sort of been a complicated one because the United States and Russia need each other and have had to have some level of coordination because they're both conducting air operations there, but at the same time, they're backing different sides. And we'll just have to see if that continues in Syria when Trump takes office. But sure, I mean, you know, it definitely feels the era of reset that we saw with Hillary Clinton and the early Obama years was not successful. And it feels like a new era.
Missy, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Missy Ryan is the national security reporter for The Washington Post. She shared the latest news on the sanctions imposed on Russia by the U.S. yesterday in retaliation for its hacking during the 2016 presidential election. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, our guest will take us on a whirlwind tour of the incredibly diverse cuisines of China on this edition of Food Friday. Right now, Wisconsin's right-to-work law has been controversial since it was put into place last year. Since its implementation, it's been challenged in court numerous times. It's been temporarily struck down, put back into place, protested by its detractors, and hailed as a victory for the Wisconsin economy by its proponents. But in a new lawsuit challenging the law, a small portion of it was ruled unconstitutional by a federal circuit court judge this week. Molly Willems joins us now to talk about the ruling. She's the Wisconsin reporter for the Courthouse News Service. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what part of Wisconsin's right-to-work law did this ruling specifically address?
This one addressed what are called dues checkoff authorizations. Now, in layman's terms, that essentially means an employee can tell their employer to withdraw union dues from their paycheck. So there was a provision in federal law before 2015 Wisconsin Act 1 that was controlling that said an employee can agree to that, and the union and the employer can require them to stick with it for a year. Now, the right to work law said an employee can withdraw at any time with 30 days notice. So where in the past, they basically had a limited window of 15 days within the year period to withdraw from their year-long agreement to pay union dues. Now it basically said all you need to do is tell them a month in advance and they can no longer charge you for union dues. And basically what the judge found was that there's already a federal law that addresses that and it preempts this part of the state law.
And what does that federal law say exactly?
The federal law says that unions can require employees to sign year-long contracts. So the federal law essentially allows a union to say, if you agree to pay union dues, you have to do so for a year at least. What the state law said was there's no requirement that you adhere to that year-long agreement.
And so does this apply just to union members, or does this apply to other people working in a place where a union represents people, whether or not they're actually part of that union?
That's a good question. Actually, under the right to work law in Wisconsin, what essentially the right to work law in general and is most known for getting rid of is requiring non-union members to pay the union any kind of money or fair share payments. So right now, any employee is not required to pay anything to a union, no matter what kind of benefits they get. So as far as I know, this only applies to union members. But as far as if the law gets overturned or something gets changed, that could potentially also affect those fair share payments that non-members pay.
So who brought this case?
This was actually a couple of unions. They've been the main folks kind of opposing right to work because it obviously sort of negatively impacts them. They're the ones who benefit from having these union dues paid. So this was a couple locals of the International Association of Machinists.
And I'm assuming that they had a very specific situation that they had to refer to in order to bring this case. What were the specifics of what they put in their complaint?
You're exactly right. Lisa Applin worked for John Deere, actually. And after 2015 Act 1, also known as the Right to Work Law, was passed, she turned in a letter to John Deere, her employer, that said after 30 days after receiving this letter, do not take any more money from my paychecks and give it to the union. John Deere was initially hesitant to do that, but actually the state, the Department of Workforce Development, came out and supported her and said, you know, she's right. This is under the new right to work law. She's allowed to do this. And when John Deere said, okay, you know, we'll go agree with you, we'll agree with the state, that's when the unions brought suit.
And against whom were the unions bringing suit in this? Was it John Deere or was it the state of Wisconsin?
The state of Wisconsin, sort of a handful of parties that were since dismissed. Right now it's against the head of the Employment Relations Commission and the head of the Department of Workforce Development. Those are the only remaining defendants.
We're speaking with Molly Willems right now. She's the Wisconsin reporter for the Courthouse News Service, and we're discussing a recent ruling that struck down part of Wisconsin's right to work law. Now, Molly, the same judge had declined to give the union an immediate injunction on this topic this summer, but then ruled in their favor ultimately. Is that surprising?
Not really. As he pointed out when he denied the injunction, it's a fairly low bar to essentially continue a case, even if you don't get an injunction. To get an injunction, there are several things that a person has to show. You have to show that you will be irreparably harmed, for example. And the union, when they asked for an injunction, according to the judge, really didn't do all that much to prove that. They didn't say, you know, here's how much money we will lose. Here's how we'll lose the money if we don't get the injunction versus if we do get the injunction. It was just sort of a cursory thing that a lot of folks do when they file challenging a law. So that wasn't very surprising. But yeah, at the end of the day, a lot of these go along political lines. And this judge who overturned it is an Obama appointee, whereas a judge in the past who had supported the law was a Reagan appointee. So that wasn't terribly surprising to see that happen.
Right-to-work laws are in place in more than half of the states in the nation, including Wisconsin. Can you remind us what those laws generally address, what kind of topics they cover?
Sure. The thing that they're most known for, they obviously have these other kind of provisions as we're discussing here, but they essentially forbid unions, from charging non-members what are called fair share payments. So they say you cannot be forced, essentially, to pay a union anything ever as a condition of employment. The two kind of arguments here are Republicans tend to be in favor of, they say, individual employees who say, I shouldn't have to pay for a thing that I don't want. You shouldn't ever be able to force an employee to pay for something that they've decided that they don't want to pay for. The other side of the coin is unions, and typically supported by liberals, Democrats, et cetera, are of the mind all employees benefit from our bargaining. So when, for example, if the union bargains for a pay increase, everybody gets the pay increase, right? It isn't just the union members. And so their idea is we're providing the service and you're benefiting from it whether you want to or not. Thus, you know, involuntary servitude is one of the arguments that they've advanced. It's illegal to make someone work or someone or a union work for free, essentially.
And before this, have there been other decisions that have limited Wisconsin's right to work law?
There were kind of back and forth. Actually, a judge in Dane County, so a state judge, whereas this current lawsuit is federal, had struck down the law, had completely eliminated it. Not uncommon. Again, Dane County is kind of known for sometimes the Dane County Circuit Court has been known in the past for kind of knocking down these conservative initiatives because Dane County is quite liberal. But actually, it's before the state appeals court now. And the appeals court basically said, ignore that. The law is still in effect while we are deciding that. And there were challenges, again, in the federal court. Right now, this one is in a separate case, is before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. But the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which controls Wisconsin and Indiana and a handful of other states, upheld a very similar law in Indiana. So I think that, as Attorney General Brad Schimmel often points out, it wouldn't make sense for the Seventh Circuit to uphold Indiana's law and not uphold Wisconsin's law.
So there are some challenges that we'll be keeping an eye on. And in this particular ruling, Molly, is it likely to stand, or have we gotten any signals about whether the state will appeal?
Nothing so far. I got the standard response from the state, which is they're reviewing the decision. As of right now, they haven't filed an appeal. It could be that they're waiting to see kind of the outcome of some of these other decisions, but frankly, this is compared to the big sort of the white whale of right to work laws. This is comparatively small potatoes.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Judith. It was my pleasure.
Molly Willems is the Wisconsin reporter for the Courthouse News Service. She joined us to talk about a portion of Wisconsin's right to work law that was ruled unconstitutional this week. Coming up after the news, China is made up of several regions and states, each with its own unique cuisine. On Food Friday, we'll learn about the rich and diverse food heritage of China and get some delicious recipes to try at home. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the election dominated the news in 2016, but there were a lot of other news items in Wisconsin as well. We'll look back at some of the top stories with Rob Menser. First, Chinese food is one of the oldest culinary traditions in human history. But when many people think of Chinese food, they often think of only a small section of it. Cantonese food, Sichuan cooking, or maybe Beijing dumplings. But China has 34 provinces and regions, and each of these has a unique geography, climate, and ethnic background. All of these elements contribute to the rich cuisine and to China's deep and diverse food history. Today we're learning about the different kinds of cooking that China has to offer. Keelum Chan joins us now via Skype very early in the morning for him from Hong Kong. He's the co-author of the giant book, China, the Cookbook. His father was the editor-in-chief and food critic for a prominent Hong Kong newspaper. Keelum, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon.
It's great to have you with us. And again, thank you for getting up so early. So how important would you say that food is to Chinese culture?
It probably ranks number one in terms of importance. I'm getting some echoes for some reason. Anyway, it is very important to us, and often we greet each other. So that is foremost in our minds, food.
We're having a little hard time hearing you. So you said it's very important to Chinese culture. Is it also very important to Chinese social gatherings?
Oh, yes, because Chinese food is very much for sharing. Okay, it is a chance for the family to get together with friends to celebrate or something like that. So food is important because it is something that we share together, and that gives us a great chance to communicate, to share ideas and share feelings and so on. So food is more than just something to put in the stomach. It is something for us to give us a chance to socialize. And so yes, food is important.
And you share in the book that one of your first cooking lessons was from your father, and it revolved around roasting a duck. What happened with that?
Well, he was having a banquet at home, and of course, while he prepares many dishes, he gave me the chore of doing a roast duck, and I had seen him done it beforehand. So I said, no problem. You know, I lit a charcoal stove and put the duck on the fork and start roasting it. Well, the way I see it is that when the color of the duck is nice golden brown, the duck is done. So I sort of know. Sat on a little stool and with a fork in hand with a big duck at the end of it, and roasted for, I would say, somewhere around, maybe half an hour. And the color was great, beautiful, nice brown color. And I said, great, now duck's done. It also smelled very good. Well, anyway, but when it comes time to serve the duck and chopping it open, well, it wasn't quite done in the center. So
I'm guessing it was quite raw in the center, actually.
Yeah, so anyway, so the duck was not served because it just could not be eaten. But fortunately, I was not scolded by my father. He knew that I had not done it before. But he told me, he said, look, you know, if you want to cook, cook with your heart, not just with your hands. But that he means that you have to think about what you do, okay? Beforehand, before you start doing it, think about, for example, what is a cooked duck? How should it be done and so on? So this is something that stayed with me. I would say it was my first lesson in cooking, and it's something that has stayed with me for the last many, many years. And this is something I put in all my books, Cook with Your Heart.
Now, you and your wife did this cookbook together. Mm-hmm. How did you choose the recipes that are in it? Because there are so many to choose from.
That was quite a difficult thing to do. We struggled quite a bit. We set up certain criteria. Number one is that the ingredients must be available, or a substitute can be found, okay, because it's no good to have a recipe when you cannot get ingredients. And secondly is that the outcome, when the dish is done, it's got to be something I think that would be acceptable to people outside of China. Okay, not something strange and so on. So something that I would say a normal family would we're looking at our heart. This is something very tasty and very good, so it's going to be acceptable. And thirdly, the balance is important because we have so many regions and sub-regions. We want to make sure that each of the regions is represented to some degree, okay, some more or some less, but they should be there, okay, because China is such a big country, and we want people to know about the diversity and the various things they can do. So balance is important for us to make sure that all the regions are represented. And then the other thing we need to think about was the ingredients. For example, I cannot have a book half of which are fish. Okay, so it's got to be a balance between fish and various types of meat and vegetable and so on. And then, of course, lastly, the style of cooking. We have soup, we have desserts, we have, whatever. Okay, so it's got to be quite well represented in total and in good balance. And we spent quite a bit of time struggling over how to select and which one to select from. But ultimately, when the book was done, I think we were quite pleased with the result.
And you're talking about how you chose the recipes and finding that balance, but that's exactly what you recommend for people to do when they're planning a meal that they're going to cook for family or friends, to finding that balance. And that includes also things like cool dishes and hot dishes and crispy dishes and soft dishes. Why is that balance so important in Chinese cuisine?
Well, I think it's a balance of flavor. For example, we want to make sure that when we have a meal, it's not all the same taste. We want to know, let's say, for example, we can have sweet and sour, we can have salty food and so on. And because eating is a form of enjoyment, okay, and we want to experience various kinds of flavors and colors and so on when we eat. So it is important for us to plan our meal ahead of time. And secondly is that, no, it is actually quite a bit of work to put out a meal for many people, whether it's in Chinese, American, or otherwise. And I think it is important to plan ahead of time. And usually in the kitchen, when you do too many things similar, then you have trouble because time is limited and you want to share with your friends. So plan ahead of time. We can do some cold dishes at half time, maybe some deep frying and then with a quick frying to follow. And so on, because you plan based on what you have at home, equipment-wise, and based on the techniques you use, so that when it comes time to serve dinner, you're well-planned and things will follow very, very smoothly, rather than having all the dishes bunched up together and then you don't know which one to serve first. So that is important, planning, having the right balance, having the right kind of taste, and also having the right kind of a sequence. It is important for us to have things like the heavier taste food would come later, with a lighter, more bland food comes first, because your palate will not be destroyed. For example, if you start with a very hot dish and then you follow by something less so, and then your palate will not be able to differentiate the different kind of flavors. So I think that is important.
We're talking with Keelum Chan right now. His book is China, the Cookbook, and it is a massive undertaking and clearly one that was undertaken with love. His father was the editor-in-chief and food critic for a prominent Hong Kong newspaper, and that's in large part where he got his love of cooking. And Keelum, so let's dig into some of these specifics, because I'm already hungry and I want to talk about some of these recipes. So one of the areas that you talk about is Guangdong. And what are some of the examples of the cuisine from Guangdong?
Well, probably the most famous dish from Guangdong that I think most Americans would know is sweet and sour spare rib, but sweet and sour pork. This is also a favorite in China as well. So I would say if we talk about Canton Guangdong food, you cannot get away from sweet and sour spare rib. Some people say this is American invention. Well, it is not so. It is really, truly a Chinese dish. Probably introduced about 200 years ago, I would say, because a lot of foreigners came to China at around that time. And so sweet and sour, I think, sweet and sour spare was created about that time because, again, I think the flavor was probably more acceptable to people new to China, a nice blend with sweet and sour. And that sweet and sour pork was introduced into America, I think, in the late 19th century, when a lot of Chinese workers went to America to work on the railroads or whatever. And then when they opened restaurants, that was probably the first dish they did, and they were accepted by the Americans.
And what are some of main flavors in that dish? What are some of the main flavors in those sweet and sour spare ribs?
Well, actually, I would say, of course, you have to. We use vinegar and sugar. Those are the two prime ingredients. But other than that, we use spare ribs. We have bell peppers. We have pineapple. And that's pretty much it. It's a very easy dish to do. You deep fry the spare ribs first, and then you stir fry with the vegetable and the sauce. And it really only takes a few minutes to do.
And we've posted a link to Keelum's recipe for sweet and sour spare ribs on the Central Time page of the WPR website, and it's also linked on the Central Time Facebook page. And now another one that sounds really good to me, and this one comes from Hong Kong, the recipe for shrimp with vermicelli. And what is it about that dish that you enjoy?
Okay. This is actually one of our creation at home. Hong Kong, as you may well know, is quite international. Not exactly from all the foreign countries, but also we take a lot of ideas from China mainland as well. This is really created based on a Sichuanese style of cooking shrimps. Okay, a little bit hot and spicy. And then we added vermicelli to it to absorb the sauces that come from cooking the shrimps. So this is, I would say, this is a home creation. And all of our guests love it. And then usually when it's done and if they're leftovers, they would say, can I have a doggy bag to bring them home?
So, and is there much of a sauce with that, or is it more of a dry dish?
Well, it's sort of dry because the vermicelli absorb most of the sauces. But it is not totally dry. You have some sauce, so it's a little bit wet. Okay, so it's not dry like maybe chow mein or something like that, but it's not saucy as well because you don't have a lot of sauce floating around on surrounding the vermicelli. So I would say it's a moist dish. Okay, people would carry it. In fact, the flavor went all the flavor went into the vermicelli because they absorb all the flavors, and this is the part that people enjoy most.
Well, and I want to say that you make a note that Americans in general like their shrimp peeled and everything taken off it, but you say that Chinese people tend to leave the shells and the heads on for flavor, and I want to agree with you. That adds so much flavor.
Yeah, that is true, because people don't know that shells and heads have a lot of flavor in itself. Sometimes, we do peel our shrimp sometimes. And when I do that, I would save the head and the shell. I would put it in a little water and cook it for about half an hour, and then extract the broth from it. So that's like a shrimp broth. I would save it, and then next time when I do something like noodles, I would use that broth and make it into a shrimp noodle. Very, very tasty.
I agree with you. We're talking to Keelum Chan right now about all of the different kinds of Chinese cuisine. He has put them all together in a beautiful book. It's called China, the Cookbook. And we're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Chinese cooking or Chinese baking? What Chinese or Chinese-inspired dishes do you like to cook at home or would like to? You can call now at 800-642-1234 or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're picking up our discussion now about Chinese cooking with Keelum Chan. He and his wife wrote a gigantic cookbook over 700 pages, and it's chock full of wonderful Chinese recipes. The book is called China, the Cookbook. And we're taking your calls now, too, at 800-642-1234. What kind of Chinese cooking do you do at home? What are some of your favorite ingredients that you use in Chinese cuisine? And what questions do you have for Keelum about Chinese cooking? Call in and share your recipes or with your questions now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, Keelum, over and over in your book, I read about how important fresh ingredients are. And when you say fresh, I think it's a pretty high level. How fresh do you mean?
Well, when it comes to vegetables, we would buy vegetables that are picked in the morning, okay, same day. We don't buy day-old vegetables, okay? And when we buy fish, it should be something that is swimming in the tank, not something on a sheet of ice. That's the preferred fish, of course. And then when it comes to meat, it's got to be something that is slaughtered on the same day. So typically, the slaughterhouses will do the animals early in the morning, and by the time market opens up, we get fresh meat. So this is how fresh we would like it to be.
And you made a point of saying that, that might not be possible for a lot of people shopping in the U.S., especially with the meat, but that there are small things you can do, like instead of buying cut-up chicken to cook, at least buy a whole chicken because it's probably a little fresher overall.
I think that is true, and not only is it fresher, it actually tastes better. We believe meat with bones on it has a much better flavor. So we would always like to have our chicken whole. Similarly to fish, we would eat the fish. We would take a whole fish. If we want fillet, we would do the fillet ourselves or ask the fishmonger to do the filleting. But that would guarantee some freshness rather than something prepackaged and one has absolutely no idea how long it has been. So this is, I would say, something that I would advise people who cannot get the swimming fish or something like that, try to get the whole piece and then do the cutting up yourself. I think that would be a little bit fresher.
Let's go to our listeners now. Larry in Reidsville is on the line. Hi, Larry.
Hello.
Hi, Larry.
This probably pertains to what you just said about serving the whole fish, but I've noticed for birds, animals of all sorts, when served in China, they include the head and the feet in the dish. And I was wondering, is there any symbolism behind including the head and the whole body when they serve an entree?
Thanks for the call.
it depends. Probably not. But on the other hand, for example, if you take a chicken, okay, we usually serve the chicken with the head and the tail. And in a sense, it is for completeness. Because when we cook the chicken, we cook the chicken whole. And oftentimes, the chicken is used in offerings. Sometimes, for certain people, and it's an ancient old tradition, they would make offerings to the ancestors or to the gods and to Buddha or whatever. And when they do that, they offer the whole chicken rather than cut up pieces. And so this is how we serve something like this, a chicken or a fish, because of its wholeness, its completeness. Rather than cut up, this is pretty much what we do with smaller pieces of animals, like fish and chicken. Of course, we can't do with a pig and head and beef and all that, and that's for practical reasons. But I would say, yes, it sort of symbolizes completeness, if I can say that. Of course, besides that, I think oftentimes the fish head tastes very good. I like it myself. So when we serve a fish, head and tails are really the choiciest part of the fish, and people would fight for it, and people would say, mm-hmm. who gets the fish, who gets the head, and who gets the tail. But that's just on the practical side of something that we like to eat. But symbolic-wise, it is, I think, for completeness more than anything else.
Thanks for that call, Larry. And Keelum, I wanted to ask you, there were periods in China's history where food was scarce. And I'm guessing that must have had an impact on how the cuisine developed. Do you see signs of that?
Yes, I think so. This is something that evolved through history. We've had all kinds of events like wars, famines, and natural disasters and so on. So when people cook, they try to use every part, all of the ingredients. And nothing goes to waste. They will always think of ways to make use of all the parts, whether it's meat or vegetable and so on. And even the poorest people, with whatever stuff they can get, would come up with ingenious ways of making use of it. So nothing ever goes to waste. And that reflects, in a sense, it's a result of our history. It is something that evolves through history. And people learn to make use of everything. Nothing goes to waste.
Russ in Monroe is on the line. Let's go there. Hi, Russ.
I'm a big fan of NPR, especially Food Friday. I like to cook, and if I wanted to cook some items out of your guest book, are there items you could recommend for my pantry that would kind of get me ready to do various dishes beyond soy sauce, obviously,
sure.
and oyster sauce?
Great. Thanks, Russ. So, Keelum, what are some of the things that we should always have in our pantry to be able to make good Chinese food?
I think Russ already mentioned that, soy sauce, oyster sauce, and I think with a little vinegar, of course, it's important to us. I think those are just the basic ingredients. With that, you can do most kinds of Chinese foods, except for some specialty foods where we say, I need a special kind of paste and sauce. Sesame oil is important. I add a certain flavor to it. It's very, very nice. Aside from that, you don't really need much. So I would say most homes can do Chinese cooking anytime, because if you already have a bottle of soy sauce at home, oyster sauce, if you have it, that's fine. If you don't have it, that is also okay. I would say soy sauce, vinegar, sesame oil are the three basic things you should have at home, and everything else is just extras.
And Keelum, I want to make sure, because I know that a lot of people are listening and I think are going to be interested in checking out your wonderful book. Let's talk briefly as we wrap up here about serving sizes, because you say that traditionally in China, you cook one dish for each person that's there and then everyone shares everything. So when there's a serving size in your cookbook, what does that mean exactly?
Well, when we cook a dish, for example, a dish, we can, if you share with, I'm going to say, let's say, dishes for four people, that means four people can share into dish, and in each person we get a pretty ample portion. Of course, a dish that says four person can also be served to eight people, but then that means that you have another dish that also has, you know, can be shared. So I would say serving is sort of like a guide. We never really cook for one.
And we'll have to leave it there. Keelum, thank you so much for joining us today. It was great, and for getting up early to join us. That was Keelum Chan, co-author of China, the Cookbook. He joined us via Skype live from Hong Kong early in the morning. The baking goods company Bob's Red Mill recently asked food bloggers around the country to come up with a cookie that represents the spirit and taste of their home state. The project is called the United States of Cookies. Wisconsinite Lindsay Moe, who blogs at theliveinkitchen.com, was tapped to come up with ours. And her creation is, are you ready for this? The buttery bourbon cherry cookie. I asked Lindsay what inspired her.
Well, they taste a lot like an old-fashioned cocktail, which is quintessentially Wisconsin. And I tried to come at it from three directions. One, butter. I mean, obviously, Wisconsin's dairy industry is amazing. Two, cherries. I use Door County cherries, which are great. And three, bourbon, which is delicious, and everyone knows Wisconsin loves to drink.
Well, looking at some other states, Arizona has the prickly pear, orange, pecan, shortbread thumbprint cookies. Berry baked Alaska cookies are from, you guessed it, Alaska. Key lime cookies from Florida. And easy sugar cookies with maple frosting come from Vermont. Massachusetts has Boston cream pie cookies. And Hawaii, this one sounds pretty good, macadamia nut shortbread cookies dipped in white chocolate. Well, we have Lindsay Moe's recipe for buttery bourbon cherry cookies up on the Central Time Facebook page. They might be perfect to ring in the new year with. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And stay tuned. You're listening to Central Time.